Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. The vote was not even close. NAFTA passed in the House. But the question now is, how close are the opposing sides? Pretty far apart, we'll have a report. Also, a creepy story from our gardener. And the Superfund Teachers Institute at Morgan State University, an EPA project out to achieve environmental justice.
The teachers, in their final evaluations, said that information was the most powerful tool they had, and that they felt the Institute gave them information they had not had before.
The Environment Show, a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont. Call 1-800-CAR-HERE. And by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. And this is Bruce Robertson.
On this vote, the yeas are 234, the nays are 200, and the bill is passed.
Hey. Speaker of the House Thomas Foley announcing the final tally passing the North American Free Trade Agreement. The debate and vote in the House was considered the truest test of whether NAFTA is viable. It is. Only, the debate continues. Stuart Hudson is special legislative representative with the National Wildlife Federation. The Federation was one of the mainline environmental organizations that supported the NAFTA. In fact, Hudson testified before congressional committees to encourage the positive vote. Hudson says he is pleased indeed to count the vote.
We always argued that free trade, as it was done in the past, is not adequate for the environmental needs of today. What we achieved with the NAFTA is a victory both for the people and the environment of North America. It's unprecedented in the environmental provisions it contains, and there's no going backward from here on in.
Having studied the text of the agreement, Hudson feels confident in his support of the now all but certain deal.
The first thing that's important to recognize is that we have protection of our food safety standards. Both the opponents and the proponents of NAFTA worked hard to make sure that the NAFTA language was superior to the GATT, and we got what we wanted. So the burden of proof is on countries challenging standard. It's not going to be on a country defending a standard. The definition of science is ample enough to protect our laws. And a number of other changes were made in the agreement that protect our food safety standards. In addition, another issue that arose was the need for better enforcement of environmental laws, particularly in Mexico. The NAFTA has the unprecedented provision which allows the imposition of fines or sanctions in the case where a country is not enforcing its laws. It also brings $8 billion to border cleanup, which is something that those citizens living in that area don't need to wait for. They've waited too long already, and passage of NAFTA speeds up the funds that are necessary to address the very real problems they live with on a daily basis.
The question of enforcement is, of course, at the center of the controversy. Fine, say opponents, write up a set of rules, but how good are they if the rules are not enforced? And further, how can we enforce the enforcers? We'll come back to that in a moment. As was well documented, organized labor stood in clear opposition to the agreement. So did several mainline environmental organizations, including Greenpeace and the Sierra Club. Thea Lee is an economist working on the international trade issues at the Washington, D.C.-based Economic Policy Institute. EPI stood clearly in opposition to the agreement.
We're not opposed to trading with Mexico or Canada. We're not opposed even to investment moving between the three countries. But the particular set of rules that were contained in NAFTA as it ended up coming down, we thought were very lopsided, very favorable towards big businesses, and contained very little to protect workers or the environment or even small businesses that were not mobile and were going to stay in the United States. And I guess we have a vision of a trading relationship that could be more broadly beneficial to working people and the environment in all three countries. And we felt that NAFTA, in that sense, was really locking in the policies of the past that haven't worked all that well, that have led to environmental destruction and increasingly unequal distribution of income.
As we said, there is not much point in voicing opinion one way or the other at this point. The results were clear. However, though disappointed, Lee is holding her ground.
It's not the end of the world, and it's not the solution to all of our problems, but it does, it accelerates the trends that were already in place that I think were not all that favorable. And right now the challenge, I think, is going to be to try to continue to manage this process of economic integration and to control the impact on the environment and to keep an eye on what happens to jobs and wages in the United States and in Mexico. I think we will try to use the side agreements on labor and the environment to the fullest extent possible. We think that those side agreements were way too weak.
Able to give us a for instance? I hear so much mm-hmm. about that these side agreements were crafted just to do that, to improve where there was a lack, but then those are, as you and others are saying, that these side agreements are still too weak. Could you give us an example of what you mean by weak there?
Sure, I'll give you a couple of examples. Just at the most basic level, the side agreements didn't aim very high. That all they try to do is to encourage national enforcement of national law. And what they could have done, in contrast, is to work towards an upward harmonization of standards to a higher international standard. And, you know, in some areas, the laws are roughly similar in the three countries, and in some areas, the laws are much weaker in some countries than in other countries. And so in those areas, the side agreements really don't even begin to address the issue. For example, some kinds of pesticides are regulated in the United States, and there is no upper limit or no limit on their use in Mexico. Child labor laws are weaker in Mexico than they are in the United States. And so there wasn't an attempt made to harmonize upward. But I think the other issue is whether the processes included in the side agreements are likely to be effective, if they're going to really provide an effective deterrent to the kinds of actions, to violations of labor and environmental standards. And I think the answer is no, because they were designed to be lengthy and cumbersome and not to work. And the process in the labor side agreements, for example, takes several years before any kind of fine or sanction might even be imposed. In the case of child labor, as some people have pointed out, the kids will be grown up and off to somewhere else by the time these side agreements work. And if you contrast it to the kinds of protections that are in NAFTA for investment rules, for copyright protection, and so on, it's really a big difference that those penalties are swift and much more transparent than the ones in the labor and environmental side agreements. And then the other problem is that there's a whole class of both labor and environmental laws that weren't even touched by the side agreements. In the case of the labor side agreement, labor rights, industrial labor rights, the right to organize a trade union, the freedom of association, the right to strike, are not protected by the labor side agreement. The only things that are protected by the labor side agreement are minimum wage, child labor, and health and safety laws. And those are protected to the extent that every country has to enforce their own laws as they're on the books today, but not necessarily improve those laws.
In the case of environmental issues not even addressed, Lee says there is nothing about natural resource management. Water, timber, minerals. Does the federal government of Canada, Mexico, or the United States have the right and the power to protect its natural resources from private development? Lee says the agreement does not spell out how or if this could be done. As we said, the chief argument against the agreement had to do with enforcement. Stuart Hudson says, no problem.
If a country is not enforcing its environmental laws, we now have the possibility that they're going to have to face fines and sanctions. Not many people know this who were apart from the negotiations, but one of the options was that the only enforcement issue that would be relevant would be enforcement that affected trade between nations. What we achieved in the NAFTA negotiations, however, was a more encompassing view of enforcement so that it's any environmental law, whether or not it affects trade between the three countries of North America. Giving the very wide scope that entails, again, it's fairly notable that we now have this North American Commission on Environmental Cooperation that will allow us to address issues that hitherto were not addressed or even considered relevant to trade.
Another leading argument against the agreement was over the difference between Mexico's more lax environmental regulations and those in the United States and Canada. Hudson says the agreement will reach its fullest potential when the Mexican standards are brought up to standard. In the weeks and months leading up to the vote in Washington, Mexican President Salinas grew increasingly concerned about his domestic economic scene, And many observers were saying that in bad economic times, whether in the United States or in Mexico, it is difficult to keep up the spirit of environmental protectionism. Hudson says NAFTA will address this by working to reduce poverty.
By reducing poverty in that or any other country, and by providing jobs, another thing that NAFTA can do if implemented properly, it allows a country to then lift its head at the horizon and look at issues like environment and not feel that it has always constrained to think about what's going to happen the next day as opposed to what's going to happen the next year or 10 years from now. And it's that long-term perspective that is very important for environment and promoting sustainable development.
Stuart Hudson, legislative correspondent with the National Wildlife Federation. Just as President Clinton celebrated victory in NAFTA, he began a new series of talks with nations of the Pacific Rim, and the GATT talks may one day provide another trading bloc. One interesting question: when all the alliances are complete, who is going to be left out, and why, and to what effect? This is Bruce Robertson. The secret to a successful compost bin is not so much what you put in it, but what you do to it afterward. In fact, it's not exactly what you do to it. It's what gets done to it by one secret ingredient you need to add. Larry Somke, the environmental gardener, says to understand this, we need to get a worm's eye view. Let's go find out what this is all about.
Hey, Larry, you down there?
Yeah, Bruce, I'm down here. Come on down.
Larry's down in his basement here. See what he's doing. What are you doing down here, Larry?
I'm getting ready to recycle some kitchen scraps.
What are you throwing the scraps in this box for, though?
Well, I'm feeding my worms is what I'm doing. I've got a worm composting bin here, and I'm just getting ready to put some apple scraps. I had an apple for lunch, and I'm putting some apple scraps in here, all the peelings and the core and the little chopped up pieces, and I put them in there, and my worms that are in there are going to eat those.
You're saying this, you're going by this too fast. Worms?
Yes.
What are you doing with worms?
This is my little worm ranch. I'm a vermiculturist now, and this is something that I really encourage people to get involved in, especially if they have kids, and that is start composting kitchen scraps in a worm bin. And I basically have a bin that's about a foot high. This is a hard plastic bin that I got from the Gardener Supply Catalog. It's about a foot high and about, 36 inches long and maybe 24 inches wide. And I've got bedding of newspaper and peat moss and some potting soil in the bottom. And I have about 2 pounds of red wriggler or wiggler root worms down in here. And they are going to eat all of this garbage that I put in here. And it's not really garbage. It's good, clean kitchen scraps. All of this kitchen scraps that I put in there, they're going to eat it. They're going to recycle it. They're going to compost it and turn it into worm casings and good, valuable fertilizer.
And the species of worm is important here?
It is. You can't just go out and dig up a bunch of worms from the backyard like night crawlers and things like that. These are a special type of worm that are, it's a common worm, but it's, and it has a, you know, a Latin name, but it's, they're well known as red worms or red wigglers. They're about, an inch and a half to 2 inches long and fairly thin, like pipe cleaners, about as wide as pipe cleaners. But they're, well, let me dig a couple of them up here for you. See, there they are.
Oh, yeah.
See, and they're very nice little worms, good-looking
wriggling
worms,
away.
Wriggling away, and they're having a good time in here. So any kind of box will do, but you have to make sure you put some drainage in it, dig some, you know, wooden box is fine, put some holes in it, and make sure you put some bedding of newspaper and something like that in it, and then just make sure you put scraps. Now, when you add kitchen scraps, you don't want to add meat and grease and difficult things to digest. You really want to add more of the vegetable scraps, the plant scraps. Even a little bit of paper will go in there. And the finer you chew it up or cut it up, the easier it is for the worms to digest it and get to it.
Now, Larry, when you get ready, when the soil is ready, first of all, how long will that take for
it
to be ready?
Well, this will probably take about 3 or 4 months before the worms, or maybe a little longer. It all depends.
And then when it is ready, how do you get
how
the
do you
soil
harvest this
out,
stuff
without,
out of here?
Without the worms?
Well, you just simply move all of the matter that's in the bucket or the box over to one side. And that includes all the worms, everything. Move everybody over to one side, halfway, move them over to one half. And then put down fresh bedding and fresh food on the other side that you just cleared out. And then all the worms will just migrate back over there. Just remember when Bullwinkle Moose was a worm herder and he shepherded all the worms up to Frostbite Falls? Well, you're doing something just like that. Move all the stuff over to one side, put fresh bedding down, fresh food, the worms will come.
And they will vacate the
other
the
stuff,
now
the good stuff.
Soil. Right.
Right. And you take that and you gather all of that up, and then you can put that on your houseplants. You can put that out in the garden. It's one of the best, most beneficial sources of fertilizer and organic matter that you can get your hands on.
And finally, you can do this in any room or any place in the house.
Well, we're down in the basement. The basement's a good place, but you could do it in the kitchen if you wanted to. The kids could do it up in their bedroom if they wanted to. It's a great project for kids. It's a great way for kids to get involved in composting, learning about the garden. And it's actually just a lot of fun. It's a great party joke. Hey, look, you want to go see my worms? So it is a great thing, and the worms are not, like I said, they're not always easy to find, but a well-stocked lawn and garden center might have them. You can order them from mail order, or contact your cooperative extension. Most cooperative extension offices know all about this, and they can help you get them.
Well, it's an earthy topic and an earthy conversation, Larry.
Yeah.
We'll see you next time.
I'm going to watch my worms do the mambo in here, and come by anytime.
Certainly. See you next time.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Larry Somke, the environmental gardener, author of Beautiful Easy Gardens. Both he and his worms live in Hollowville, New York. And this is Bruce Robertson. In his 1990 epic work, Dumping in Dixie, Robert Bullard spelled out what many in minority communities nationwide have felt all along.
If we look at the environmental justice movement that is emerging in many communities of color around this country, we can see that whether it's the fight against landfill, the fight against incinerators by Native Americans, by African Americans, or by Latinos, it's basically a struggle for justice. It's a struggle for equity and to fend off discrimination. We can see the civil rights movement was basically a movement for economic and social justice, whereas communities of color right now are trying to address inequities that are created as a result of decisions that locate landfills and these unwanted facilities directly in their path of least resistance, which oftentimes mean poor communities, low-income communities, black communities.
Bullard is a professor of sociology at the University of California, Riverside. This thing called environmental justice, or environmental racism, has been acknowledged by many organizations and many studies, including one from the General Accounting Office, as well as the Commission on Racial Justice. Speaking at a busy reception in his honor recently, Bullard said it is no accident at all that this is being done deliberately.
What we find is increasing evidence that the siting of landfills, incinerators, and hazardous waste facilities follow a path of least resistance. These facilities are located disproportionately in communities of color. It's a pattern that is rather predictable in determining which communities get dumped on. Oftentimes, communities are powerless in making decisions. They don't have individuals, representatives on boards, commissions, in many cases, city council representatives. Study after study have clearly documented that these are not accidents. Even in the whole notion of low-income communities not being involved in community. This is the myth. Environmental organizations have existed in communities, low-income communities, for a long period of time. They just haven't been named environment. These are social justice groups. They are groups are fighting all kinds of issues, and these community organizations want the same thing that all communities want, a clean environment.
There was a concern that governmental regulation and compliance may have contributed to the problem.
Marjorie Buchholz, Director of External Affairs at the Environmental Protection Agency. Under her supervision, the EPA established the Superfund Teachers Institute at Morgan State University in Baltimore, Maryland. The purpose, says Buchholz, was to give citizens the power and the knowledge to fight back if they want to. To reach the people, Buchholz reasoned, it would be easiest to reach the teachers first.
We felt that teachers oftentimes become ad hoc spokespersons when there are contentious site issues in a community. And yet, as an agency, we felt we had done an insufficient job at providing accurate information on health risks, on procedures and policies, and on environmental rulemaking, so that citizens who live in the communities would know how and be empowered to fully participate in the processes that contributed to regulations and land property management in their home areas.
To be eligible, Buchholz says, the teachers had to have been from a minority community and, more specifically, lived near a Superfund or RCRA, Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, site. More importantly, says Buchholz, the teachers had to be teaching in one of those communities.
Our goal in that regard was to ensure that not only were teachers educated and well-informed about EPA processes and policies, but also that they would learn, that we hired a professional teacher to be executive director of the Institute who has great skill at helping teachers infuse their curriculum with environmental subjects and to make environmental teaching interesting and lively and to make young people both want to be good citizens with respect to the environment, but also to want to look further and go into environmental careers.
If the goal was to provide the tools to get into environmental careers or to fight a particular situation in their communities, what are the tools?
The teachers in their final evaluations said that information was the most powerful tool they had and that they felt the Institute gave them information they had not had before. Information about how the agency regulates environmental protection. What are the processes before a site becomes a Superfund site? What are the different points of input? When is the public meeting? How do I get involved? How do I bring a group of people? What right do I have to review the hazard ranking system information? Where can I find that information? How can I translate it? The basic information that people need to participate in the entire process from the beginning, you know, till the site is cleaned up.
As with any teaching experience, the learning happens with both the students and the teachers. The teachers who are attending the Institute, acting as students in this case, surely were learning a lot. However, Buchholz says those doing the teaching at the Institute, many of them from within the EPA, also learned a great deal.
What is the best way to deliver the information? Some of our teachers were very stern and very critical with some of our lecturers, and that was fine. They gave them a real run for their money. And some of the EPA individuals, after they left the Institute, started thinking about better ways that they could do their jobs and be more effective and try to respond to folks better at the grassroots.
Marjorie Buchholz, Director of External Affairs at the Environmental Protection Agency. She said the money to conduct this Institute was budgeted by Congress with no more guarantee of continuing it. If the agency were to get more funding next year, Buchholz says she would like to hold regional institutes around the nation so that teachers in, say, the Deep South could learn about issues peculiar to the South, while those from the Upper Midwest would learn about their issues. This may or may not happen, but Buchholz says at least once is better than never at all. This is Bruce Robertson. And that's our report on the Environment Show this week. Thanks much for joining us, and we hope you'll make note of the time and place and join us again next week as we do it all again. The Environment Show is a program about the environment, the air, water, soil, wildlife, and people of our common habitat. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-767-1929. Ask for the Environment Show, program number 204. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok, executive producer. This is Bruce Robertson. Thanks to C-SPAN, the Cable Satellite Public Affairs Network, for coverage of the NAFTA vote. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York and by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont. Call 1-800-CARHERE.